the Heising Simons Foundation.
KQED traffic at 8:59 starts with trouble in Berkeley. Here's Michael Bennett.
Thank you, Michelle. Westbound 80 at Ashby. Several cars and a motorcycle involved in a crash. CHP estimates the car that caused the crash was traveling over 100 miles an hour. CHP has all but the left lane blocked right now. Traffic at a stop from Golden Gate Fields. In Sunnyvale, there's something in the roadway. Westbound 237 at Matilda, it's in the middle lane. I'm Michael Bennett for KQED.
Bruce Springsteen became the person who I went to for all my wisdom. There's a song you'll know, Born to Run. And in Born to Run, he says this line where he says, I want to know if love is wild. I want to know if love is real. And that was a really important question to me. Is love real for somebody like me?
Join us for stories of childhood, the joy, the heartache, and the music. That's next time on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
Saturday night at 8 and Sunday morning at 11. This is KQED San Francisco and KQEI North Highland Sacramento. It's 9 p.m.
From KQED in San Francisco, I'm Guy Marzorati in for Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, it feels like the party is over for the Tea Party. When the libertarian political organization Freedom Works closed its doors last month, it marked the end of an era for the right-wing movement for limited government. Cause of death? Well, Trump, and the rise of a MAGA-style populism less interested in reducing deficits. Others say the Tea Party's real animating forces, like cultural grievances, are alive and well in the party. Nevertheless, a new study of voting records in Congress shows Republicans are far more united around social issues than the idea of limited government. What does the shift away from the Tea Party mean for the GOP? That's next, after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Giles Snyder. U.S. military says food and other supplies will soon begin flowing into the Gaza Strip from a U.S. military-built pier. U.S. Central Command said Friday that it has been reconnected to the beach after it was damaged by storms and rough seas. Here's NPR's Tom Bowman.
The pier was operational starting May 17th, but was only moving humanitarian aid for a little over a week before a severe storm caused the pier to break apart. Pieces of the pier were towed to an Israeli port for repairs. Now ships loaded with aid from Cyprus are expected to arrive at the pier in the coming days, officials said, and then trucks will move from the pier along a causeway to the beach.
With the pier operational again, the White House is sending Secretary of State Antony Blinken back to the Middle East to push Israel and Hamas into agreeing to a ceasefire. Blinken is due in the region on Monday. It will be his eighth trip to the region since the war started. Eight of the nine Supreme Court justices released their annual financial disclosure forms Friday. While there were no bombshells, NPR's Nina Totenberg says there were some interesting tidbits.
The only justice who did not issue his financial disclosure forms was Samuel Alito, who this year, as he has often done in the past, asked for and was granted a 90-day extension. Justice Clarence Thomas took the occasion to amend his 2019 disclosure form, adding some information about a hotel room and meals in Bali paid for by GOP megadonor Harlan Crow. The disclosure report showed only two justices accepting gifts beyond the $480 limit last year. Thomas, who accepted a photo album valued at $2,000, and Ketanji Brown Jackson, who reported accepting from Beyoncé personally four concert tickets, valued at $3,700. Also, Jackson reported accepting artwork for her chambers, valued at $12,500. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
To Minneapolis, where a federal jury has convicted five people of stealing millions from taxpayer-funded child nutrition programs during the pandemic. Matt Sapik of Minnesota Public Radio reports the Justice Department says it's among the largest COVID-related fraud cases.
Jurors found five people guilty and acquitted two others on charges that they defrauded federal food programs out of $47 million by exploiting pandemic-era rule waivers that allowed restaurants and not just child care centers to participate. The group falsely claimed to have served 18 million meals as part of what federal prosecutors say was a much larger $250 million fraud scheme involving dozens of others. As the five-week trial concluded, the presiding judge on Monday jailed the defendants after a juror reported that someone offered her $120,000 in cash in exchange for an acquittal vote. For NPR News, I'm Matt Sepik in Minneapolis.
And you're listening to NPR News. Hunter Biden's federal gun trial in Delaware is to resume Monday when the defense could announce whether Hunter Biden will testify. On Friday, the jury was dismissed for the weekend after hearing from Biden's daughter, Naomi. The case could go to the jury next week. Hunter Biden faces a separate tax trial in California in September. Native American tribes that use water from the Colorado River say they want a bigger voice and talks about its future. Groups that use the river's water met in Colorado ahead of a deadline for new rules to share the supply, as Alex Hager of member station KUNC reports.
Tribal leaders say their long history of exclusion from water management is still alive today. Lorelei Cloud, vice chairwoman of the Southern Ute Indian Tribe, said recent agreements between states and tribes are a good start, but more needs to be done.
I'm asking everybody in here to normalize tribal voices being at the decision-making table, letting us make those decisions that affect our people.
Another tribal leader from Arizona said some people in water talks are actively trying to divide and conquer tribes and pit them against one another. He said he's confident those efforts won't work because tribes share a, quote, sacred and historic bond. For NPR News, I'm Alex Hager in Boulder, Colorado.
Hockey Stanley Cup final gets underway this weekend. The first game in the best of seven between the Edmonton Oilers and the Florida Panthers is set for Saturday night in Miami. The Oilers are seeking their sixth championship. Florida is looking to hoist the cup for the first time. I'm Giles Snyder. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Rockefeller Foundation, making opportunity universal and sustainable for over 100 years, and the Public Welfare Foundation, committed to advancing transformative youth and criminal justice reforms.
This week in KQED Science, how to stay cool and safe during a California heat wave, plus the untapped potential of rooftop solar on non-residential buildings. Find those stories and more at kqed.org/science. Expect cool temperatures this weekend with a slight warm-up slated for next week. The National Weather Service says Bay Area highs will be in the 60s and 70s tomorrow. Sacramento and Lake Tahoe will have weekend highs in the 80s.
This is Forum. I'm Guy Marzorati, in for Mina Kim. We're talking this morning about the decline of the Tea Party movement within the Republican Party. One of the movement's political engines, the group Freedom Works, closed its doors last month, and a new study from the Institute for Legislative Analysis finds that Republicans in Congress are no longer unifying around limited government positions on fiscal issues. Joining me to discuss are the institution's president, Fred McGrath. Fred, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me today.
And Vanessa Williamson, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. Vanessa, good morning.
Well, glad to be here. Thank you.
So, Fred, maybe I'll start with you. What were your thoughts, big picture, when you heard about the end of the Freedom Works organization?
Well, it was certainly somewhat of a mixed emotions. It's like one of those things where I'm not surprised, just having kind of seen the trends, but you still hate to see such a influential and impactful organization in its day just, you know, close up shop. But it really, again, looking at the data from our latest report, really, I think, paints the full picture of what actually happened with that closure. So the Institute for Legislative Analysis conducted the largest vote study ever performed on the U.S. Congress. We sampled over 65,000 votes. And what the study did was it showed that right now, the current U.S. Congress, from a fiscal limited government position, is right in the middle It's a the average score of Republicans is a 50%, and we actually have more Republicans, 146 of the 275, voting more in line with the progressive and left position than they do with the limited government and the more conservative side.
Hmm.
So seeing that, it's certainly not a surprise about why Freedom Works ultimately closed.
Vanessa, how would you describe Freedom Works' significance within the Tea Party movement? And were you surprised at its closure?
Oh, I certainly was not surprised. The Tea Party was, in some ways, very much a grassroots movement that organizations like Freedom Works tried to harness the energy of, right? This is in the very early days of the Obama administration. Grassroots conservatives were very concerned about Barack Obama for a lot of reasons, some of which, you know, really played into later movements with Trump in terms of concern about Obama not being an American citizen, concerns about immigration and those sorts of issues. And elite-led conservative groups like Freedom Works really tried to harness that energy in opposition to Barack Obama to push forward a conservative economic agenda that was in many ways at odds with the base. So there was always, from the very beginning, a real tension in the work of groups like Freedom Works, because it wasn't actually the issue that was motivating rank-and-file Republicans.
Hmm. And what were, in your mind, those kind of foundational principles motivating Tea Party voters, both in substance and in style?
So if you look at survey data about supporters of the Tea Party, they were consistently conservative Republicans. They tended to have stronger levels of racial resentment, stronger fears of immigration than other Americans. And they were also supportive of many of the major portions of the welfare state in the United States. These were older Americans, and so things like Social Security and Medicare were either benefits they were already receiving or benefits they were expecting to receive within just a few years. So the sort of cultural concerns of the Tea Party were really at the forefront whenever you attended their meetings or you went to their rallies. There was a sense that the country had changed and that Barack Obama represented that change. And so it was always a little bit of an uncomfortable fit, I think, to try and push that energy into a concerted effort for cutbacks to popular social programs like Social Security.
Hmm. Fred, Dan McLaughlin writes in the National Review that the Tea Party movement, quote, in truth has been dead since Donald Trump descended the escalator at Trump Tower in June 2015. Do you agree with that?
I don't know if you can directly say that Trump went against the core of the Tea Party. In many ways, President Trump, you know, has still, you know, the budgets and stuff that he proposed in Congress, you know, they were drawn and created by a number of members that were influential and had a large role in the Tea Party. I think what more happened was you see the major expenditures and stuff that happened under his presidency. You know, a lot of that was just within Congress. You know, those were bills that, yes, I think fiscal conservatives would have said they'd love to see him, you know, be a little bit more aggressive on the veto front. But to say that all of a sudden his philosophy, you know, directly took out the Tea Party, I'm not sure if that's really the case.
Hmm. Vanessa, how do you make of that kind of push and pull that we saw when Trump was president between, yeah, maybe more Tea Party aligned proposals that would emerge from Republican study committees versus, you know, the kind of things Trump was talking about at large rallies?
Well, I think it's important to recognize what distinguished Trump from a large Republican field when he ran for president. His numbers started going up when he started talking about immigration, and when he started talking about immigration in ways that, frankly, were racist. And that found an audience, and it found an audience that other Republicans had not been willing to tap into. So I think that, you know, we definitely can see the sort of development of the sort of MAGA politics, both in terms of the strong anti-immigration stance and also the sort of conspiratorial thinking, you know, concern that Barack Obama was not a citizen, for example, is very similar to the kind of concerns you see about illegal immigrants voting, right? That's one of the recurring conspiracy theories in the sort of MAGA era. So I think there's very much a connection to be drawn there. In terms of, you know, fiscal conservatism in the sense of wanting to balance the budget by raising taxes or cutting spending, I don't really think that represents either the MAGA movement or the Tea Party particularly well, because that was never actually the driving force of either of these movements.
Yeah, I mean, I think we'll talk a lot this hour about the ways in which the influence of Tea Party members and organizations have declined. But I think it's worth noting all that has carried over from the Tea Party era into the Trump era. I'm thinking of cultural grievances, norm breaking. I mean, what do you see?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I think that the sort of very public, very angry protests and very much seeing one's political opponents as one's enemies is a thread that you can really pick directly from the Tea Party movement to the MAGA era. It has grown more extreme, but, you know, when I attended Tea Party meetings, you know, more than a decade ago, it was very common for people to perceive Democrats, to perceive liberals as basically illegitimate political actors, that they didn't, it wasn't that there were two sides and you disagreed and you had to compromise and you might want to try and persuade someone. No, it was very much that there was a participation in politics represented by Barack Obama's supporters that was illegitimate and should not have been, you know, that you didn't have to compromise with because they didn't actually deserve to participate. In its most extreme form, that took, you know, that became a conspiracy theory about people actually literally not being allowed, legitimate actors not actually being allowed to vote.
And do you see parallels too in the way candidates are running under the Tea Party banner and maybe the MAGA banner in terms of imagery, rhetoric?
Well, I mean, one of the most striking pieces of imagery in the Tea Party era was, you know, the adoption of Revolutionary War costumes. I don't know if people remember this, but the tricorn hats and you know, waving the American flag and all of this sort of thing. It was obviously Americana belongs to all Americans, but the symbolism was really used in a way to distinguish conservative activists as seeing themselves as the true representation of America versus the illegitimate and un-American opposition they perceived in the Democratic Party and in particular as it related to Barack Obama.
And Fred, there have been, I think, plenty of obituaries written about the Tea Party long before this. I think back to even Mitt Romney's victory in the 2012 GOP primary. Does this moment feel different to you, though?
Yes, from a vote and policy perspective in Congress. And kind of the one best example I like to point to is, again, this study we conducted was in 2023. We go back a decade prior, so 2013, and look at kind of the same exact policies that are being discussed now and how Republicans were voting. And one of the best kind of apples to apples comparison is back in 2013, there was a fiscal amendment that had to do with cutting rural air service subsidies. Now, of course, the Tea Party was very heavily fiscally minded and heavily against all spending. In that case, you had 137 Republicans support kind of cutting government and that spending to only 88 opposing. Today, you take an almost identical amendment actually introduced by another California Democrat, or sorry, Republican, Tom McClintock, very conservative. He had the same exact amendment he brought to the floor, except in this case, only 49 Republicans supported cutting the spending to the program versus 174 allowing it to continue. So you see that big shift in voting and shift on the fiscal side. I think that's the best teller from how things have changed.
Yeah, just in the course of a decade there. Vanessa, does this moment feel different to you, different than past maybe end of Tea Party narrative discussions?
Well, I think the politics of the sort of grassroots part has certainly moved farther to the right and has become more extreme. I think there's also been a, you know, more of a disconnect with sort of basic sort of facts and also an increased unwillingness to see compromise as legitimate. In terms of fiscal matters, I think that the Republican Party has for 40 years been moving to a position in which, for example, tax cuts don't need to be paid for, right? This is something that has a long trajectory because tax cuts are popular in a way that spending cuts are not. And so as the Republican Party moved towards a position where cutting taxes did not and thereby running up very large deficits did not need to be offset in any meaningful way, I think that sort of fiscal core of the Republican Party has really lost has really lost ground. But that preceded the Tea Party to a substantial degree and continued afterwards.
Yeah. We're talking about the death of the Tea Party and what it means for the future of Republican politics. That was Vanessa Williamson, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, co-author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism. We've also been talking with Fred McGrath, president of the Institute for Legislative Analysis, an organization that collects data for advocates of limited government and did a comprehensive study of congressional voting records. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation and talk more about what this shift means for the Republican Party towards a populist agenda for 2024 and beyond. And we're also going to take your calls. Stay with us.
Support for KQED comes from Xfinity. With their Wi-Fi Boost Pod, in-home wall-to-wall Wi-Fi offers coverage throughout the home. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary. Coming up at 10 o'clock tonight on Tech Nation, science journalist Annalee Newitz talks about her book, Stories Are Weapons, Psychological Warfare and the American Mind. Then, the latest on wearable technology, what wearables are doing now that they weren't doing before. That's on Tech Nation with Dr. Moira Gunn, coming up tonight at 10. I'm Michelle Hennigan. The announcers and technical staff of KQED Radio are affiliated with the National Association of Broadcast Employees and Technicians, CWA Local 51, AFL-CIO. We're listening to the rebroadcast of this morning's forum, so the producers are not here to take your phone calls tonight. It's 9:20. And this is KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Guy Marzorati, and for Mina Kim, we're talking about the death of the Tea Party and what it means for the future of Republican politics. We're with Vanessa Williamson, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution and co-author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism, Fred McGrath, president of the Institute for Legislative Analysis, which provides scorecards for advocates of limited government, and joining the conversation, Duncan Braid, coalition director of American Compass, a conservative think tank. Hey, Duncan, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Guy.
And we also want to hear from you. What do you think is the legacy of the Tea Party? Where do you see the Republican Party headed in 2024 and beyond? And especially if you're a Republican voter, do you feel like you've been part of this shift, particularly on economic and fiscal issues? Or do you feel the party has moved away from you in some way over the course of the last decade? You can email your comments and questions to forum@kqed.org or find us on Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram. We're at KQED Forum. Or give us a call right now. Our phone lines are open, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. So, Duncan, let me get your kind of big picture thoughts. What did you make when you heard that FreedomWorks was shutting its doors?
Well, I wasn't terribly surprised, particularly given the sort of letter that they sent out at the end of 2023 saying that they were sort of pivoting away from being a conservative organization to more focusing on independent voters, which seemed so far from their previous bread and butter, which didn't speak to the overall health of the organization. I think FreedomWorks' core problem, and has been kind of the core problem of DC Republicans when it comes to the Tea Party to begin with, is sort of conflating a populist and anti-elite movement, first and foremost, with that of a ideological libertarian one. The concerns raised by the Tea Party when it was founded was largely in reaction, in my view, to sort of the what was perceived as the unfairness of the program responding to the Great Recession. And so naturally that's going to touch on government spending issues, but that wasn't the heart and the primary motivating factor for it. And the sort of misinterpretation of this as being, well, this is first and foremost a libertarian movement emphasizing radical cuts to the government and radical tax cuts, I think was misplaced. Sorry, go ahead.
No, right. And Fred, you've kind of documented this in your study at the Institute for Legislative Analysis, that there has been a shift in voting records, though, in the House among Republicans. So let's maybe dive into some of your research. One area you identify Republicans moving away from a limited government position are bills on education. kind of tell us what you're seeing there.
Yes. Well, just kind of even more broad, when you're looking at just the fiscal side and really the cultural side, I like to kind of have those two sides. On the fiscal side, as I mentioned earlier, you had a 50% Republican average on where they stand on the issues. On the cultural side, you have a 97% as far as, you know, a very limited government, or more actually, I would say, conservative perspective on those issues. So you're just seeing this very stark divide. And it seems that over time, more and more emphasis is just more focused, being focused on the culture wars, rather than just the more kind of bread and butter tax fiscal issues that Republicans have carried over the years. And of course, when the whole movement starts to shift, well, you know, what are members of Congress? They're representatives of their constituents. So they're going to also shift in their voting as well.
Right. But when we think about who is, you know, taking these votes, Republicans elected during the Tea Party's heyday, how would you break down, you know, how many of those folks are just no longer in the House versus, as you say, maybe members shifting as they take on different signals from their electorate?
You know, when you look at Congress overall, yes, you definitely have changes part, you know, year over year, different election cycles. But, you know, there's still always a number of members, and I would say probably the majority, who have been in there for many, many years. You know, Mitch McConnell is a perfect example. You know, you look at some of his early positions on kind of just general, the ideology scale. He was very hardcore conservative and has shifted downwards. You know, so that's why we really like to focus more on the issues themselves and making comparisons rather than just member to member, because overall that paints the bigger picture of where part the party is actually heading.
Mm-hmm. So give us some examples. What are, you know, specific bill areas or policy areas where maybe you're noticing the greatest shift?
Yes, I think one of the biggest, again, when we're looking back a decade ago at the heyday of the Tea Party, and now that would be the trade issue. You know, I like to look at back in 2013, one of the big discussions was the Colombia Free Trade Agreement, you know, reducing barriers and tariffs. At that time, you look at the Senate, Republicans supported that bill 44-2. The Democrats were the ones that were divided. Only 22 supported and 30 opposed. Now, you fast forward to today, we recently last Congress had an amendment brought forward by Josh Hawley to impose a 25% blanket tariff on all Chinese goods. There, you had the Democrats almost unanimously opposing it. And now the split is amongst Republicans. 17 Republican senators supported that bill and to 31 opposing. And of course, from a fiscal, you know, side of things, you know, tariff protectionism is one of the worst things that can occur to an economy and growth. So I think that should alarm a number of real conservative focused conservatives and Republicans.
Well, I think that's certainly up for debate, even within the Republican Party. But Vanessa, when you see this shift, how much do you attribute to Tea Party supporters simply getting older? I mean, if you were an activist, you know, working against the Affordable Care Act, for example, at age 50, you know, you're now well into your older years. How much do you attribute to that?
No, I think it's important to remember that. I think that, you know, if you look at, for example, the average age of a Fox News watcher, and Tea Party supporters were almost exclusively Fox News watchers, you know, there was 65, and that was, you know, 15 years ago. So we are talking about people who are really reaching their later years, and I think that necessarily reduces people's capacity for activism. But if we're talking about what's driving shifts in attitudes about tariffs, I think this is at a base level the sort of thing that Tea Party activists were very interested in. There was a lot of concern about immigration, about foreign influence, about China. All of these things are issues that would have appealed to the grassroots space of the Tea Party, though it would not necessarily have appealed to sort of elite groups like Freedom Works, right? So it to me, it's absolutely the case that the grassroots activists of the Tea Party are sort of necessarily, you know, less influential than they would have been 15 years ago. But the primary concerns of the Tea Party about, you know, sort of immigration, about other countries, about America changing in cultural ways, those things are absolutely at the core of the Republican Party today.
Duncan, do you agree with that, that there perhaps was an undercurrent of support for policies like tariffs, maybe more populist economic policies within the Tea Party base that simply was not being heeded by elected officials?
Absolutely. I mean, there's sort of a, I really liked the report that ILA put out, but I do think it sort of comes from, again, a sort of particular elite conception of what is and what isn't conservative. If we're talking about the tariff, and I believe it is coded in that report as something that is a vote against limited government, I mean, we think about back to the founding, the very first act considered by the legislature and passed by the legislature was a tariff. So if the very first bill that was passed by Congress under the Constitution is a violation of limited government, I would find that to be a bit shocking, certainly from jump. And I think Tea Party activists were very much are animated first and foremost by a feeling that they are being treated unfairly by the government, being treated unfairly by big businesses. And that's the core element of their reaction. And sometimes that manifests itself in negative ways. But people will often dismiss these as sort of grievance politics. But I believe that they were and continue to rightly aggrieved in a number of ways.
Fred, I don't want to get into make this a tariff debate show, but do you have any response to what Duncan's saying?
And for our methodology, you know, we look at what is the proper role of government and really measuring the level of government involvement. So we have things such as tariffs. I mean, what is a tariff? Well, that's politicians putting regulations and barriers to entry of goods. So again, that is a government involvement, and it depends on to what level, you know, you're talking of, you know, low tariff to high tariff. A true free market, which, you know, most economists, especially the conservative side, you know, early on, free market will go and tell you is that, you know, again, a true free economy is you know, without trade barriers. That's an ultimate, you know, letting the free market allow goods to flow rather than government intervention, which, again, I would say is a tariff.
We're talking about the decline of the Tea Party and what it means for the future of Republican politics. That was Fred McGrath, president of the Institute for Legislative Analysis. And we're going to take your calls as well and your comments. Our phone lines are open, 866-733-6786. And you can also send questions and comments to us on our social channels at KQED Forum or forum at kqed.org. We have a comment from a listener, Greg, who writes, quote, "You can try to sugarcoat it, but the Tea Party was a visceral white tribal reaction to the election of Barack Obama. You can come up with other fantasy explanations like limited government and freedom, but that's not at all true," writes Greg. Vanessa, what do you make of Greg's take there?
I think he is correct to identify concerns about Barack Obama, concerns about Barack Obama as, you know, not being seen as a true American, that was very much wrapped up in racial resentments and very much wrapped up in concerns about immigration and concerns about how the country's demography was changing. And, you know, you can see that in the survey data. If you look at people who supported the Tea Party, they were substantially more racially resentful than other Americans. And they were even more racially resentful than other conservative Republicans. They're part of what drew people to the Tea Party was a visceral reaction to Barack Obama. And so I think that is an important part of the story. And I think, you know, it's exactly right to see that those instincts don't necessarily drive people into a politics about tariffs, right? That's just not, it's not what the natural progression of those thoughts is. And so I think that's one of the reasons why groups like Freedom Works had a hard time finding their footing when it came time to sort of proposing policies as opposed to simply opposing policies.
We're going to go to the phones now. We have a call from Chris in Oakland. Hey, Chris, good morning.
Good morning. I'd like for your guest to comment on the difference in attitudes of the Republican Party and the Tea Party toward economic elites as opposed to cultural elites. The Republicans have largely created a tax system where rich people and rich corporations pay no taxes. They've put out unlimited money to people like Elon Musk, and they make sure that rich people continue to get all the benefits, like the bailouts from the financial crash, and poor people, which includes many Tea Party people, bear all the burdens.
All right, Chris, thank you so much for your call this morning. Duncan, how do you kind of weigh those animating forces, push back against cultural elites versus economic elites?
Well, I don't think there's too much of a substantive difference. Cultural elites often tend to be quite wealthy themselves. But I think he points to quite one of the animating reasons why Donald Trump was able to get a hold on the Republican Party in the first place, is it very much seemed to be out of completely out of touch with the concerns of its voters, and sort of reacting to the exact thing that the caller was pointing to, where all benefits will move any mountain for big business, but when it comes to the average person and their concerns and what's going on in their daily lives, that is big government. We wouldn't touch that sort of thing. So I think that really does speak to just sort of, well, when Trump came down the escalator, it was such a big deal, and why people were able to gravitate to that. And he's, in spite of the challenges that he has, he continues to be a sort of leading figure in the center right.
Mm-hmm. As you know, someone who spent time in the Trump administration, how did you see the former president kind of position himself in relation to Tea Party policies, specifically ones that might have been more libertarian leaning? And what does that mean? What would you expect in a second Trump term?
Well, you can see it in a lot of his appointments in chief as a chief of staff. You think of the sort of leading lights being former Congressman Mark Meadows and Mick Mulvaney, and obviously taking into account his OMB director Russ Vogt, and the budgets that he put out were ones that very much did a number of conventional things, but also a number of new things. If you think about the sort of spending proposals that he would propose for the various departments, were very much in line with some of the more conventional concerns of Tea Party politicians and, I think, Tea Party voters themselves. As far as a Trump second term, I think that the new right has a lot more to say now, because you think back to 2017, the majority of the policy was very much in line with the sort of conventional thrust of the establishment Republican Party. The very first two things we did in the legislative session was a tax cut and a failed Obamacare repeal. I think next time the legislative agenda will be quite different. Of course, we are looking at the expiration of the TCJA here, and what that inevitably looks like is open for debate.
Mm-hmm. We have a question from a listener as we talk about the demise of Freedom Works, this political organization behind the Tea Party. The listener asks, do you think Freedom Works would consider the sum of their financial support of the Tea Party as a worthwhile or profitable effort? What are the gains and goals they believe they achieved? And in terms of funding a going concern, was this a worthwhile effort overall? That might be a difficult question to unpack, but Fred, what would you say?
Yeah, well, I think it's always smart to try to follow the money. You know, ultimately, you know, you have nonprofits, think tanks, activist groups. Well, ultimately, how are they funded? It's usually through the more wealthy donors and what their initiatives and beliefs are. And I think, you know, you go back a decade ago, obviously Freedom Works, you look at the issues that they were focused on, you know, it aligned with kind of those views of those donors. Of course, what happens, you start with the donors, it goes to the activist groups, and then it ultimately shows up in the way that members of Congress vote. Now you're seeing a new set of priorities, which I think, you know, we can see from the study with ILA and all, that it has shifted now to a more cultural focus. It's less as much about that kind of traditional tax fiscal side, and it's more trying to win the culture wars. And I think, as you know, this panel has discussed, it's, you know, we're going to see, you know, obviously the outcome of the election. But if President Trump comes in, it seems too, on the cultural side, he is probably more to the moderate side of where the party is, especially where you're looking at, you know, kind of his statements and stuff around abortion. So in many ways, it's going to be very interesting to see how this election ultimately, you know, shakes out, you know, the whole views within the Republican Party and its donors.
Lots more to discuss. We're talking about the decline of the Tea Party, what it means for the future of Republican politics going forward, especially with an eye on 2024. When we come back, we'll continue our discussion about the Tea Party's evolution, what it all means for the year's election and governance in Washington, and we'll continue to take your calls. Our phones are open, 866-733-6786. More to come. Stay with us. Coming up Monday on Forum with Mina Kim, with its term drawing to a close, the U.S. Supreme Court is getting ready to rule on major issues like abortion access, gun regulations, and whether former President Trump has immunity from civil litigation. Meanwhile, Justice Samuel Alito is still facing questions and calls for recusal over political flags flown at his houses. We'll look at the ethics controversies swirling around the court and what the upcoming rulings could mean for the presidential election, the country, and you. To listen to past Forum shows, go to Spotify or Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Just search KQED Forum. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Guy Marzorati and from Mina Kim. We're talking about the decline of the Tea Party after Freedom Works, a libertarian political organization that was a driving force behind the movement, closes doors. What does the potential sunset of this movement mean for the future of Republican politics? We're joined by Vanessa Williamson, senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, co-author of The Tea Party and the Remaking of Republican Conservatism, Fred McGrath, president of the Institute for Legislative Analysis, and Duncan Braid, coalition director at American Compass. And we want to hear from you, especially if you're a Republican voter, and do you feel like you've been a part of this shift from the Tea Party to the more Trump-aligned MAGA movement? Did the Tea Party have an impact on your community in terms of policies? Did it have an impact on the way that you have voted? Email your comments and questions to forum at kqed.org. You can find us on our social channels and Discord community. Don't forget about that, at KQED Forum. Or give us a call now, 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. And Duncan Braid, I want to get your thoughts on a vote this year that I think really kind of captures the essence of this discussion. And that was on this bipartisan bills to push a sale of TikTok, or a ban if that sale didn't happen, over the free market objections we heard from Republicans like Tom McClintock here in California. What stood out to you about that debate?
Well, what stood out to me about that debate was the sort of libertarian concerns that typically were overriding previously, where there was like, oh, well, is this interfering in a private enterprise, largely rang hollow. And I think for a number of reasons, this was the case. It's just the sort of rote arguments that interfering in any private property in any context just didn't work in that instance because, well, if you actually take the issue as it is, where you have the Chinese Communist government owning the platform, there was sort of an overriding concern there that, well, this will impact national security. It's probably not ideal for one of the largest social media platforms in the country to be controlled by an adversary. So, I think that the primary element that you can sort of take away from that is that this more conventional argument that intervening to achieve a goal, even if it was a good one, is just off the table for conservatives. So I think that is a very positive step, actually achieving achieving conservative ends via public policy is something that we find to be a good and desirable thing that members of the elected branch should be doing, even if it occasionally, even if it has some sort of tangential nexus to something that we wouldn't have considered a few years ago.
Fred, what did you make about that vote on TikTok? Did that kind of fit in this vote shift that you've been studying?
Yes, it really kind of shows that kind of now clash, especially obviously that the tech sector has been under a lot of debate amongst, you know, just within the conservative movement. I would actually go maybe a little step further and really diving into that issue. And yes, we had the federal government, you know, getting involved, but a lot of where I've seen that debate on TikTok happening is more in the states. You know, a number of states, Republicans there have focused more on banning TikTok on government servers, you know, by government employees, and of course, letting the private sector, you know, kind of do what it wants. But there's been some states like Montana that kind of duplicated that same federal level ideology and banned it across the board. Now, I think from a limited government perspective, you know, there's obviously a role of government to protect, you know, national security interests and ensure, you know, public safety and all that. But I think it's fair to have a debate on, you know, what is going too far and what is really the proper role and scope. And I think it's great to see kind of those debates within those discussions.
We're going to go back to the phones now with Lewis in El Cerrito. Lewis, good morning, and thank you so much for calling into Forum.
Hi. Good morning. I'm sorry, I was in my car. A great show. I just wanted to relay one point that I hope comes through coherently. I think I was talking to a Trump supporter in El Cerrito last Saturday during breakfast, and one of the things that came across to me was that the Tea Party people, whether you agreed with them or not, were engaged in the system and they were fighting for something, even if we may think it was miscast, but they were fighting something and they sort of understood how the system worked. The people who are the descendants of the Tea Party, now seem to me they're not part of that. And what this woman said to me, which I thought was very poignant, was that they feel like they're a commodity. So it's nobody's listening to them. They don't know how to engage the system. And I think that's part of the huge disconnect. I realize your study was, you know, maybe going after a little something different, but I think it's an important element on the sort of cultural side of things.
Yeah, thank you so much, Lewis. Really appreciate your call. Vanessa, what do you make of what Lewis raises?
Yeah, you know, it was something that actually came up a bit in when I was studying the Tea Party, when I was visiting their meetings and that sort of thing, is that on the one hand, Tea Party activists were engaging in a kind of politics that, you know, people like political scientists like me are glad to see. That is to be, they say they were attending meetings, they knew what their local government was doing, they were involved, they were doing sort of civic activism of a kind that, you know, has a very proud tradition in American politics. But at the same time, that engagement came with a sense that their opponents were their enemies, right? That their opponents did not have the right to engage for their own ends that were different. And so I think that there's a real mix there in terms of how, you know, how positive one can see political engagement if it means that you see your opponents as illegitimate actors. And so I think that that's something that just grew in the Trump era. To the point that, you know, sort of an entire sort of movement built around the idea that other people are not legitimate participants in politics is, you know, sort of in important ways damaging the very foundation of our politics now. So I think the caller was exactly right to see that that thread and also how it's changed.
Duncan, there's another school of thought that says that this shift, certainly within the Republican Party, towards more of a populist mindset on economic issues, might open doors for more compromise. David Leonhardt in the New York Times has used the phrase neo-populism to kind of describe a new consensus where you know, Biden follows Trump and kind of along the same lines, working to confront China. Do you see this as opening the doors for more opportunities for the parties to work together on certain issues?
Absolutely. I think you've seen that in a lot of the work that Leinhart points out. I mean, the sort of challenges that the country is facing are not necessarily ones that are adequately addressed by a purely left, purely right approach. I mean, you think about the rise of China, the sort of hollowing out of the American heartland, people not earning a proper wage. These are all issues and themes that the left also touches on and also cares about deeply. We disagree strongly with a lot of their methods, but I think that there's a wealth of opportunity to sort of come together and try to get this policy right for the average American.
Do you have the sense, though, that elected Republicans might be less willing to kind of lean into this populism in domestic policy? I'm thinking about things like the child tax credit. I know that's something you supported a version of, but it's been blasted by kind of the Wall Street Journal editorial board. It's not getting GOP support in the U.S. Senate. Is there a fair kind of dividing line between moving in this direction and in confronting China and then actually domestic policy?
Well, it's sort of it's an interesting generational divide, and it's even an interesting divide between the House and the Senate, because the Smith-Wyden did pass with majority Republican support. So it is presently in the Senate just something that is just, I think there's a concern about potentially giving the administration a win here. I don't think it's necessarily opposition to the politics itself. Certainly the business tax cuts are something that are the more moderate members of the conference are interested in. But when it comes to the actual messaging of Smith-Wyden, which we thought was incredibly encouraging, was that the start of that story was that it was going to be a simple trade for we would keep these tax expenditures, and in exchange for Democrat votes, we would do the child tax credit. And I think Chairman Smith actually recognized and did an excellent job of being like, well, wait a second. These are both actually Republican priorities. Supporting American families and supporting businesses are both well within the conservative imagination here. So I think, though, that it has been stopped in the Senate for, I think, largely political considerations, I think that that is the broad framework of the future of the Republican Party.
Hmm. Fred, do you see opportunities here for bipartisanship in this shift, maybe around industrial policy, promotion of certain industries?
Well, I think that's kind of the fun part of politics, and really the most interesting part is just how all these different representatives from districts all across the country view these issues and represent their constituents. And, you know, that's why we publish our ratings. You can see on limitedgov.org, every single member of Republican, every single Democrat member, exactly where they stand on the issues, how limited government, how more aggressive government. And I think kind of what you'll see is, you know, there are certain members who are obviously going to work or want to, you know, be a little bit more bipartisan than others, or have, you know, stronger or, you know, just differing views on different policies. So it's just, that's kind of what makes our political system fun to watch from all across the country.
Certainly. I want to get to a couple listener comments on Discord and through email. We have a comment from Lawrence who says, you know, I think the Tea Party died when Trump defeated Ted Cruz for the 2016 Republican nomination. Also, do guests think the libertarians of Freedom Works will go along with Project 2025, which would destroy the administrative state? I want to get back to the presidential piece in a second, but Fred, maybe just on the administrative state, that seems an area in which Republicans are kind of held together on votes, as you've tracked.
Yes, I mean, there's certain areas where you definitely have a much stronger, and you've highlighted there on certain what is, you know, certain law scope of government on you know, the administrative side. But even looking at the Democrat side, which is, you know, something we haven't really talked a whole lot about.
That's another show.
yeah. You know, our study has shown there, you know, Democrats are generally much more united together on the issues. And you'll see kind of really the only areas that we're seeing a whole lot of divide on now are areas such as like the the crime, the criminal justice reform, you know, starting now to push back against a lot of those things, and also some of the regulations. But, you know, as a whole, you know, each of these parties on certain policies, they like to clump together. And some are, of course, some policies are much more divided.
You're listening to Forum. I'm Guy Marzorati in for Mina Kim. And I want to get back to the second piece of that listener's question, Vanessa, which was about, you know, the presidential elections and maybe that being a defining moment in the decline of the Tea Party. I do think some people kind of point to the Tea Party's failure in being exemplified through the inability of candidates to take that final step and capture the White House. I'm thinking of, you know, Ron Paul in 2012, Ted Cruz in 2016. Was there a defining bug in your mind that held those candidates back?
Well, I think that, you know, in fact, the first person who ever suggested to me that Donald Trump was a contender for the presidency was a Tea Party activist who I interviewed in 2010. So I think that Donald Trump amazingly had some form of a base among Tea Party activists long before anyone, I think, was seriously thinking about, maybe even before Donald Trump was seriously thinking about running for president. You know, I think that his platform as a, you know, as a sort of reality television show host had put him in front of a lot of people, and something about his sort of demeanor appealed. But I think that the thing that happened in 2016 was that Donald Trump revealed that you could push forward a candidacy within the Republican Party that prioritized anti-immigrant sentiment, that walked away from, you know, many of the sort of priorities that, that Fred's been talking about, and could really appeal to the Republican base. So, you know, but I don't see that as the end of the Tea Party, although maybe it was the beginning of the end for the sort of more libertarian-leaning elite groups that tried to associate themselves with the Tea Party. But for the Tea Party base, I think it was, you know, sort of a second life begins with the sort of Trump movement.
Hmm. Fred, I want to turn ahead in the couple minutes we have left to the 2024 election. The focus here in California politically has largely been on these very competitive congressional seats we have here in the state, many in suburban communities. Is the shift that you're chronicling any more or less pronounced among those suburban Republicans in swing seats, many of whom have seats that Joe Biden outpaced Donald Trump?
Right. Again, just basic politics is, you know, will always tell you, you know, when you're in a contested seat, you want to run as moderate as possible. So obviously, you know, I think our data shows that a lot of these, you know, more these Republicans in these swing districts, you know, they are voting much more moderate than you would in, you know, Republicans in very conservative districts. And it's one of those things that you look at that, you know, look at California, you see similar things in New York. But again, it that's not always the case. You know, there are certain districts all across the United States where, you know, lawmakers may not kind of properly represent their constituents. And of course, a lot of that is often hashed out in primaries. But again, that's why we like to, you know, publicize the data and just let people kind of pick through all these votes and stuff to see kind of where do they align with them. Because it's ultimately critical, I think, for people, no matter they're Democrat, they're Republican, just to make sure that, you know, their elected officials are representing their interests.
Duncan, we have about a minute left. But when we look ahead to 2024, you know, Trump was heckled a few weeks ago at the Libertarian Party convention. Do you have any concerns or thoughts that Libertarian voters, those voting really strictly around maybe balancing the budget, Trump did not do that during his first term, are they at risk of staying home, not voting for Trump in November? What are your thoughts on that moving forward?
Well, as far as the Libertarian convention goes, that always attracts the most interesting people in politics. So I'm not entirely unsurprised by that. But at the same time, I think if you are talking about actual people who share libertarian inclinations, who are not specifically members of the Libertarian Party, I think there's a lot to like with the Trump presidency, hypothetical Trump presidency. I think that he has taken spending more seriously, barring the national emergencies of the COVID pandemic. And again, I think the emphasis on getting addressing the problems of the administrative state is sort of a shared value between people who are more libertarian and more are more populist or conservative leaning. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank Duncan Braid is Coalition Director of American Compass. Thanks so much for your time this morning, Duncan. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
We also talk with Fred McGrath, President of the Institute for Legislative Analysis. Thanks, Fred.
Thanks again for having me.
And Vanessa Williamson, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institution. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
This Hour Forum is produced by Carolyn Smith, Mark Nieto. Jennifer Ng was our digital community producer, and Ashley Ng was our engagement producer this week. Susie Britton is our lead producer. Our engineers this week were Danny Bringer, Brendan Willard, and Catherine Monahan. Our interns are Emiko Oda and Annie Verdon. Our vice president of news is Ethan Tovin Lindsay, and our chief content officer is Holly Kernan. I'm Guy Marzorati. Have a great weekend, everyone.
Funds for the production of KQED's Forum are provided by the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the Generosity Foundation, the Germanicos Foundation, and